Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Natasha Trethewey, the 19th United States Poet Laureate, whose most recent book is Thrall, and Dalt Wonk, author of French Quarter Fables. We are very honored to have as our guest today Natasha Trethewey, who is the 19th Poet Laureate of the United States, as well as the Poet Laureate of the State of Mississippi. She's the Robert W. Woodruff Professor of English and Creative Writing at Emory University, but I like to think of her as one of our own, for she grew up on the Gulf Coast in nearby Gulfport, Mississippi. Her poems feel like they belong to all of us here. She is the author of several collections of poetry, domestic work, Belloxophilia, which draws from the work of the famed Storyville photographer, of course, Native Guard, the winner of the 2007 Pulitzer Prize, and most recently, Thrall. Many local readers also know her as the author of the memoir Beyond Katrina, A Meditation on the Gulf Coast. Happily for local poetry lovers, she's coming to New Orleans December 6th to read at the main branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Natasha, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
You're a professor at Emory University, but you're also the first poet laureate in a long time to take up residency at the Library of Congress. Why is that important to you?
Well, you know, there's a couple of reasons it's important to me. One personal and one that has a lot more to do with the post itself and what I might do for American poetry from my post at the Library of Congress. When I was working on my third collection of poems, Native Guard, I did a lot of research at the library. I was over in the Madison Building in the archives reading old Civil War letters and newspapers and all sorts of things in their collections. And in the afternoons, I would go back over to the Jefferson Building and sit in the lovely reading room and work on the poems. And so for me, it feels like a chance to go back to a place that was particularly inspiring to me as a poet. But I also think that if I'm there in residence, and I'll be there throughout the spring semester, I can have weekly office hours, times where people can make appointments to come in and see the Poetry Center up there on the top floor and to talk with me about poetry. Yeah, I think that's really the thing that I'm excited about, seeing what kinds of folks might want to come and talk about poetry and visit the center.
Better watch out. You could be overrun during those office hours.
That's true.
Your work...
Well, I'll have to maintain some of them to get some writing done.
Well, of course. Of course. That's what we want. Your work is deeply and complexly engaged with visual art. There's a photograph you speak of in Domestic Work that is so perfectly described that the reader can imagine it. Mm. And then you turn to the photos of Belloc for Belloxophilia. Now, I've got to tell you, we have a bar named for that photographer now, so
you may have
to visit it. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about those photographic inspirations.
Well, I started writing about photographs because I'm really drawn to visual imagery. I think as a poet just starting out many years ago, the image that seemed to be most developed, or the sense that was most developed in me, was the visual sense. And so to write a poem, I always begin with trying to make a photograph in my head, even if I don't have an existing photograph of what it is I'm trying to write about. Mm-hmm. And I continue to go back to visual imagery. I write a lot of ekphrastic poems, poems that are about painting. As you mentioned, the whole sequence of poems about the photographs of Belloc. There are a lot of paintings from the Renaissance in my most recent collection, as well as some more photographs.
I hadn't really known very much about those Acostas paintings of the colonial era. Would you describe those for us?
That's right. I did not mention that there were a lot of paintings from the 18th century as well in that collection. But these are paintings from colonial Mexico that represented the mixed-blood unions that were taking place in the colony. And so they were done in series of 16. They always began with the Spanish white father, And the names, the taxonomies used to name the mixed blood people were written right there on the painting as well. And so they kind of had an ethnographic feel in a way.
And what do you do? Do you surround yourself with these images? Do you just look until the looking's done?
Well, you know, one of the things is just to start trying to describe what it is that I see. So I will sit for a long time and look at a photograph or look at a painting. And when I write that kind of poem, I am trying very hard to make a photo or an image in the reader's mind such that they would be able to see the image without having to, you know, go to the museum or Google the image online. I want to create it as vividly as possible in the mind's eye. And so I begin with a kind of description that I hope begins to fill in the image that I see for the reader.
Also, the impulse to memorialize is so strong in your work. In Native Guard, your Pulitzer winner, you create a memorial to a Civil War group that never had a proper one.
That's right. I do that at the same time that I create a kind of living monument in language to my own mother, who I lost in 1985. It seems to me that, you know, poetry is always about creating a kind of stay against the inevitable losses, the passage of time, the loss of people that we love, forgetting, all those kinds of things that are daily overtaking us. And so part of the act of writing for me is to try to remember and to have a stay against the inevitable.
And you do that for all of us as well in such a lovely, lovely way. There's one new poem in Thrall that has occasioned a lot of discussion, and it's an elegy for your father, even though he is still alive. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the complex emotional message in that poem.
Well, you know, it is a difficult poem, and I will say that my father does like it. You know, one of the first things he said was, oh, you know, I'm lucky. Most people don't get to see these, you know, because they're gone. But the poem, for me, began in trying to have a conversation with my father that is a very intimate conversation being played out in a public forum, obviously. And I feel in many ways that because my father is a poet, the language of poetry is, of course, the language that he is most likely to listen to. But I also, in the poem, am thinking about what it means to be the daughter of a poet, to have inherited in some way through watching him all my life, what it is to live as a poet and to think that way. So there's a part in the poem that deals with what I think of as a kind of ruthlessness in which instead of completely being present in the moment that he and I are there fishing, I'm also thinking about turning that moment into a poem. Already I can see that there's something poetic about it, and I'm already planning for the poem that I'll have to write.
It's so interesting to me to see to talk to writers about who shows them that it's possible to live as a writer and to be a writer. And people never forget that when you meet your first real writer. But you grew up with that all along. Was there ever any resistance to the idea?
No, my father never pressured me to be a writer, and so I never had the opportunity to resist being one.
Very often those of us who are bookish parents have kids who refuse to read.
Right. Well, for some reason, I didn't refuse. I enjoyed it, and it seemed to make sense to me that I would write as well.
And you said that you began, really, to write poems as a way to make sense of your mother's death. Is that still why you write poems?
Well, you know, I have to clarify that. The first thing that I did when my mother was killed was to try to write some poems about it in order to make sense of it and to grapple with that grief. I think it was the kind of thing that a lot of people do when we suffer such tremendous losses, whether they are personal or public losses, like, you know, the towers going down and, on 9/11. But I didn't become a poet after that. And as a matter of fact, after writing a couple of really bad poems that tried to deal with it, I didn't write poems again for years. So when I actually started writing poems again, the first thing that I was trying to do was what ends up being a significant section in Domestic Work, my first book, which was to record so that we would not lose the stories of my grandmother and the women in her community in North Gulfport, Mississippi, who were getting old and dying. I wanted to hold on to the things that they had taught me, and it told me something about the culture and their place in it, the history that they were part of making. I wrote to keep all of that from disappearing. And that's still why I write in some ways, to make sense of all of that history that I've been given and my place in the world and my place in history.
And you write so beautifully about women's lives and the pull of relationships and power, I think. That's always a subtext in your work to me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I'm always, well, I'm interested in the things that get left out of the historical record often, or the things that get subjugated. And of course, there's always something about power involved in what gets left out or what is subjugated.
Now, it's very special to us to have you in New Orleans. You spent a fair amount of time here, haven't you?
I did, yes. Growing up, I spent summers back on the Gulf Coast with my grandmother, and then part of them over in New Orleans with my father, who lived there for 18 years.
And we should say that your father is the well-known poet Eric Trethewey, and your stepmother is the poet Catherine Soniat.
Right.
Now, and the other thing, I love this so much. After Katrina, you wrote that wonderful book, Beyond Katrina, Meditation on the Gulf Coast. And I loved it when you especially mentioned what it was like to see the library gone.
Yeah. That was one of the hardest parts for me, simply because it was so symbolic. You know, it seemed to be the iconic image for me on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, different than the iconic imagery that we saw on the news about what was happening in New Orleans. But I was able to go back home to Mississippi, and I had spent a good deal of time in that main branch of the Gulfport Public Library. Indeed, that's also a place that I did some research for Native Guard. And so to see it, to see just the kind of skeleton of it remaining, and to know now that it's not even going to be rebuilt there, breaks my heart.
I know, me too. And I think of that anguish cry of yours, which said that library was me as a girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think a lot of us think back on the libraries of our childhood that way. Well, Natasha Trethewey, it's been such a pleasure. You can meet Natasha Trethewey at the main branch of the New Orleans Public Library Thursday, December 6th at 7 p.m. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Playwright and illustrator Dot Wonk is here for a return engagement. Luna Press, the publishing enterprise Dot has begun with his wife, Josephine Sacabo, has just produced another book, Dot's Own French Quarter Fables, and it is a beauty. All righty, welcome back to The Reading Life, Dot.
Thank you, Susan.
So tell us, what is a fable, really? We usually associate them with children's literature.
Well, that's a kind of a well, nowadays people misspeak.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a misunderstanding. I mean, I don't think that the earliest fables that I think we have are Aesop's, and that wasn't for children. In fact, Aesop, they say he was a slave and that he was manumitted for his intelligence and possibly also because of his fables. And he was sent on a mission, a diplomatic mission to Delphi, and made up a fable there that so outraged the Delphians that they threw him off a cliff. So I don't think it had to do with children.
Oh.
And La Fontaine, who's another person that we think of in terms of fables, he was writing, those very much had to do with the society he was living in, which was under Louis XIV, the Sun King, and very critical of the powerful. And so while I think children are attracted to fables, especially if they're illustrated, because here you have these little animals wearing clothes, which is certainly what attracted me to the whole idea.
I know. I love that that was your inspiration.
I know. And it's so almost embarrassed to admit it. But, you know, I just love, as I said in the prologue to the book, that I'm not the only one. Look at Barkus. Everybody takes their dogs and puts costumes on them. And they all, it's just grown so much because everybody loves it. So you've got that one level of fun that kids really go for. You know, when they look at, this is an illustrated book, and the illustrations have been, at the risk of bragging, have been very well received. People really enjoy them. But especially kids, because they see these little animals and they're immediately, their eyes light up.
But adults' lives light up too,
Yes, you know. And absolutely.
And these are very adult stories. Lots of them about money, lust, all kinds of things.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I think that the reaction should be, the way I look at it, the fable is like a stem. And then the stem blooms into a flower. And the flower is more or less what we would call the moral. And that's a little unfortunate in terms of vocabulary because that sounds like you're talking about moralistic things. Whereas I think it's more like an aphorism. And your reaction is more something like, yeah, ain't it the truth? You know, it's like...
That's a very New Orleans reaction, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know...
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you're right. Because it's a lived experience. And I think fables tend to be, on the one hand, have a great deal of humor, and there's a certain kind of wit involved in a fable, but underneath there's a kind of a sadness. It has to do with the sadness of the world, and that balance, I think, is really makes them attractive.
You've been writing fables for a long time, haven't you?
Well, actually, I have, and I have no idea how I had no particular interest in fables when I got started, and it was just one of these things. I had a friend of mine, Vittorio, who is an Italian from Italy that I had worked with, where he had done illustrations and I had done the text. And I tried to interest him in doing this, and he didn't want to. And he said, well, you do the illustrations. And I was so afraid to try, because I didn't consider myself an artist, that I dug up an old, one of those tin watercolor sets that you give your child.
Oh, I love those.
Which I had given, I had given my daughter, and of course she grew up and left the house, but there it was, because I was too embarrassed to go into an art supply store. I was afraid I'd get busted as a fake. So the first fables, illustrations, I made with that darn old thing. And then somebody said, well, that's real nice, but you know, as soon as the light hits it, it's going to fade. So I worked up my nerve and I went to an art store and I bought watercolors. And then I started doing it. And then somehow I just kept coming back to it. So I'd say off and on for about 10 years I've done it. Not continually, of course, because I have other projects. But off and on, I would find myself doing some more fables.
Somebody needs to keep you in watercolor stalled. I mean, you need a constant supply.
Thank you.
So these were published in, some of these were published in an earlier version.
Yeah, some of them, a man named Julian Mutter, who is one of the owners of Doer Furniture. I knew him, and he's a very open-minded, interesting guy. And I showed him some of the original fables, and he said, well, let's publish them. And so we published them, and it was a nice book, but wasn't done as, how to put it, it wasn't done as carefully as this current book. So that was the first time they came out. But the problem with that was, you know, I made like 15 cents a book, and I didn't have a distributor and all like that kind of thing. So then I decided to do some handmade books, and I did about 600 of some more fables. And that was labor-intensive, but it was beautiful things, and that edition sold out. So some of both of those collections are included in this, but this is the ultimate final, God help me, collection of fables. A French Quarter Fables.
Well, describe the appearance of this book. This is an extraordinarily beautiful book. When you see it, you immediately reach for it. You want to touch it.
Yeah.
And all these incredible elements have gone into it. Describe some of them for us.
Well, we've put together a team. One person on the team, of course, there's Josephine, who is such a talented photographer and makes photo engravings. and I've known her for many years. And then a friend of ours, a mutual friend who was Josephine's model for about 20 years, Jacqueline, who lives in New York, she's designing the books, so we're working with her. And so it's mainly the three of us, and then there's a couple of other auxiliary people. It's much more work than I ever thought it would be to actually come up with a well-designed book that you're totally satisfied with. And that's without talking about proofreading, which would just about make you blow your brains out. But that's what it took. And then these books were printed in Iceland, of all places.
That must have been very nerve-wracking.
Oh, it was totally weird. But Jacqueline knew about this printer in Iceland, and they have an office in Brooklyn. They turn out to be very nice people, and they are very, very competent. And they were faster than Asia and cheaper than Asia. And they're really great to work with. And they will tell you things. Like, for instance, this particular book has a linen cover. And there are very delicate questions that come up. Like, for instance, it's got these red drawings on the cover. And the man from the press said, listen, that color that you picked out won't work well on linen. It'll spread too much. So he's told us to use a different color close to it. Now, if it had come out too orange, it would have made the whole thing look cheap. But the color that we chose, which he said, yeah, that'll work, was a little bit more towards brown rather than towards orange, and it looks beautiful. But having someone that you're working with, once again, on the side who really knows their business helps so much, and these people have been great.
And even the paper.
The paper's been, you see, what we're trying to do is to make, in a sense, going in the opposite direction of cyberspace. We're trying to make books that are in and of themselves almost objects of art, so that you could take this book and keep it and feel like you have got something very, very special. The high point of that kind of thing was like in Paris in the 20s, when they made those very special artist books. So, for instance, you mentioned the paper. The press people found out about a company that specializes in watercolor paper, but was going to try and do a sideline in watercolor paper thin enough to use for books, and they grabbed it. And so these illustrations are originally watercolor with pen and ink. They look like, when you look at them in this book, which is a matte finish paper and very fine paper, they look like original watercolors.
That's the great glory of this book, is that it looks both incredibly contemporary and yet almost otherworldly, as if it were an older book from a different time. Because you reach out for it because there is that gorgeous linen cover with those drawings that you can feel. The paper is very rich to the touch. The colors, the reproduction is incredibly gorgeous and rich with jewel tones. Mm-hmm. So it's a complete pleasure to look at it. So,
well, thank you, Susan.
You're very welcome. So congratulations, Dalt.
Thank you so
along
much.
Along with Nocturnes, this
thank
is one you. Of the most beautiful books I've seen.
Thank you so much.
You can see Josephine Sacabo and Dalt Wonk signing their books, Nocturnes and French Quarter Fables, at the Art of Giving at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, Friday, December 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. Thanks so much, Dalt.
Thanks again, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Maureen O'Dwyer leads a discussion of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men at the Book Club at the O, Tuesday, December 4th at 5:30 at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Jeffrey Eugenides' The Marriage Plot, Tuesday, December 4th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Benjamin Morris is the featured reader for December 1718 Reading Series, a cooperative venture of Loyola, Tulane, and University of New Orleans students. He'll read from his collection of poems, Coronary, Tuesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel. Kit Wall signs New Orleans Classic Cocktails, Tuesday, December 4th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Tom Verisco and John Biganay sign Jackson Squared, Thursday, December 6th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Today's guest, the U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey, presents a reading Thursday, December 6th at 7 p.m. at the New Orleans Public Library Main Branch. David Spielman signs When Not Performing, New Orleans Musicians, Thursday, December 6th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books, and again Saturday, December 8th at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Michael Allen Zell reads from Errata, and Jen Marie Noons reads from Strip as part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, December 6th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Dot Wonk and Josephine Sacabo sign Nocturnes and French Quarter Fables, Friday, December 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Art of Giving at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Jack Vance's Tales of the Dying Earth, Saturday, December 8th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Bill Finch signs Longleaf, As Far as the Eye Can See, Saturday, December 8th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Cornell Landry signs The Amazing Adventures of Mardi Gras Bead Dog, Saturday, December 8th from 1 to 3 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Stacy Schwest reads from and signs My Very First Christmas Tree, Saturday, December 8th at 2 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans celebrates the holiday season with a read-along of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, Saturday, December 8th from 2 to 4 in the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Bring your copy or borrow one there. Ken Foster signs I'm a Good Dog, Pit Bulls, America's Most Beautiful and Misunderstood Pet, Tuesday, December 11th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Emily Ford signs The Jews of New Orleans and the Mississippi Delta, Thursday, December 13th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Melinda Palacio signs How Fire is a Story Waiting, Thursday, December 13th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Phil Sandusky signs New Orleans Impressionist Landscapes, Saturday, December 15th at 2 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poppy Tooker signs Madame Begay's Recipes of Old New Orleans Creole Cookery, Saturday, December 15th at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. And coming up, Heather Graham's Writers for New Orleans Conference. That takes place December 14th through 16th at the Hotel Monteleone. If you love genre fiction, come on out and meet Heather Graham, James Rollins, and David Morrell. For more information and ticket info, check out writersforneworleans.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.